The scripture reading is Ecclesiastes 7, 1 through 13. A good name is better than precious ointment, in the day of death than the day of birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It is better for a man to hear the rebuke of wise than to hear the song of fools. For the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fools. This is also vanity. Surely oppression drives the wise into madness, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the heart of fools. Say not, why were the former days better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask this. Wisdom is good with inheritance, an advantage to those who see the sun. For the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money, and the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? The word of the Lord.
Good morning, everyone. What an amazing passage of scripture that is. Thank you so much, Stone, for reading it to us. My name is Mark. If you're new here, I'm one of the pastors of the church. In 1979, so about 40 years ago now, almost 40 years ago now, 60 Minutes ran a short segment on something that they termed self-care. And the big idea, as they put it forward, was that not being sick does not equate with being healthy. That simply not having an illness is not the same as being well or being whole. And the idea was that doctors are trained to treat illness, but if a person wants to progress in their health beyond the category of simply being not sick, that's up to them. They're going to have to take matters into their own hands. The medical field, the medical world, the doctors that they see are not primarily going to participate in that end. Now, that's a very helpful concept that emerged in our country about 40 years ago, probably a little bit longer than 40 years ago. It gave rise to people taking their own health and wellness much more seriously. It gave rise to all the things that we now think as normal and commonplace. They were not prior to this development of the self-care idea. Things like diet and watching carefully what it is that you consume and put into your body. People were not thinking about that all that much in the 50s and 60s in this country. Things like exercise and having a regular, even daily exercise regimen to care for your body, to make your body strong and fit, not something that was in the public consciousness prior to the late 70s. Things like taking vacations for the sake of reducing one's stress level, doing all manner of things to manage our stress levels, things like yoga and meditation and tea and all these wonderful things, massage that we look to, essential oils that effectively help us manage our stress level, even if only by way of placebo in the last case. All these things are quite good so far as it goes. This idea of self-care, it's a very good and powerful idea. It leads to greater health, greater strength in our bodies. It's wonderful. My own story, some of you may know that last year, my back failed me on two miserable occasions. The first came when I happened to be in New York City at a conference, and I got out of the shower in the morning ready for a day of conferencing and exploring downtown Manhattan, and I reached down to pick up some clothes, and I crumpled to the floor in excruciating pain and laid there for many hours that day. Getting up off that floor in New York City was, I thought at the time, the most excruciatingly painful thing that a person can possibly experience. I learned several months later that I was wrong, that it can get even worse than that, because a few months later, my family and I packed up our minivan and drove up to the Upper Peninsula for a few days of camping. And as we were preparing to leave in the rush to get ready to go camping, I was loading the car and loading the car top carrier and shoving five bicycles into the back of a minivan. And I felt my back begin to talk to me, but I didn't have time to pay attention to that because we had Airbnb customers arriving shortly and we had to get out of Dodge. And so I just pushed through and my back started to speak more and more loudly. And then rather than care for my back properly, I proceeded to get into the seated position for 7 hours driving to the Upper Peninsula and then sleep on the ground in a tent. And when I explained all this to the physician the next day, he sort of scratched his head and effectively said with his eyes, "You're stupid." But getting up off that ground that morning, that first morning of camping, was even more painful than that day in Manhattan getting up off the floor. I was weeping with pain. It took me a good 40 minutes to stand to my feet because my back was in so much agony. And all of that compelled me to the idea that maybe, just maybe, I need to take better care of myself. I had actually resigned myself to the idea of giving up on all of my athletic dreams. I started saying regularly that your 30s is where you go for all your athletic dreams to die. And I was ready to just coast from here on out, right? I'm 37 years old at that time, now 38, and I was ready to just slide into oblivion, reading books and playing chess and never going for a jog again. That sounded fine to me. And yet here my back started to speak to me that something else was in order. I'd actually made the decision in my mind that if I never put my back under any stress, then I wouldn't experience these horrible episodes. And of course, the exact opposite took place because with no stress ever on my back, all of the surrounding and supporting muscles only got weaker, and these episodes started to become more common. My wife was wonderful. She would care for me when those episodes happened, but she started to have her patience run a little bit thin, given that I had not been a member at a gym for over 7 years, nor done any vigorous exercise in that time. And she suggested that perhaps I rethink that approach to care for myself. And so this year, I've done that. You might be happy to know. This year, I joined a gym. Actually, my family and I all together joined a gym. And I started going in actually late December and then really in earnest in January when everyone goes to the gym. And I started working on my core muscles, doing planking and kettlebells, and then that morphed into some light jogging. And I started to build some confidence that there was some strength and fiber in my core, and I could trust that my back was not going to fail. And so the light jogging morphed into longer runs of 3 to 4 miles even. And then in March, the worst timing ever, I agreed to have a bright, smiling, inspirational young man come into this church and announce to all of us that there are children in other continents, on other continents, who suffer greatly for lack of clean water, and that if we Westerners would get our butts in gear and run a marathon, we could really help with that. And so I realized this probably was my moment, and here I was, invigorated by this new strength and zeal, feeling fit and strong. And so I signed up to run the Chicago Marathon later this year in October. Go me. For Team World Vision in a giant orange jersey. And I've been somewhat faithfully training since that time. Last week, I ran 10 miles without stopping. Yeah, you can cheer. I mean, that's, you know, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. On a treadmill, but still, 10 miles without stopping. I'm doing most of my training indoors. Take one look at me and you'll understand why. I don't want to burst into flames, but I felt amazing after running that 10 miles. I felt fit. I felt strong. I felt my stress level lowering. I felt my endorphins firing. And one of the best things about this new fitness, of course, is that my wife is noticing. She's in the nursery right now, so I can say whatever I want about her. She cannot keep her hands off me, let me tell you. She really appreciates me being thinner, slightly more fit. You guys are looking at me and going, you don't look that great. But compared to what I did look like, it's a world of difference. And so things are going quite well in my house. All that to say, I believe in self-care. Okay, I believe in self-care. I believe it's a powerful idea that can profoundly help people, profoundly help, has helped me. And I feel like I'm rediscovering the gift that our bodies can be if we actually take the time to take care of them. But here's the rub. All of this positive forward movement, all of this newfound fitness and strength in my body, I think actually puts me in a pretty dangerous spot, because it's possible, maybe even likely, that I could mistake this newfound level of health for wholeness. That I could start to believe that what I am discovering, this new beneficial activity that I'm discovering, I could start to mistake this for the full expression of health and wellness and wholeness. That I might actually start to believe that self-care is the way in which I become a whole person. Lest you think that's overstating it, I think many people fall into this trap, because lowering stress and getting fit and getting strong, it actually feels like wholeness in a way. Your body is shouting at you, this is so good. The endorphins that are released in you, this is so good. You feel like a fuller person, even like a complete person. And after that 10-mile run, I can tell you, I did feel like $1 million. I had that runner's high. And so here I am in that new place of fitness, my wife noticing, my wife enjoying. I'm whole, right? What more could I possibly need than this? Recently, my two boys have been learning to swim. My 8-year-old son, he's pretty much got the hang of it now. So he's learned breathing this year, which means that he can now swim the full width of the pool, which is pretty good. Still working on the length, but he can swim the full width of the pool. And my 5-year-old son, soon to be 6, he recently was awarded a ribbon for independent swimming at the Goldfish Swim School. Do you know the Goldfish Swim School? It's just down the street, less than a mile from here. This is the Amazon.com of swim schools. Okay, these people have mastered the user experience to near perfection. My 5-year-old son refused to even dip his foot into the water when we took him to the Chicago Park District swim lessons. He weeps when we miss a Goldfish Swim School lesson. So it costs 5 times as much, and it's worth every penny. Okay, so my two boys now, they've essentially mastered the shallow end of swimming. That is to say, they can both swim independently, provided that there is ground underneath to catch them if and when they need it. They're master shallow end swimmers. And so the question is, where do they go from here? Well, they don't actually ever need to become deep end swimmers. The shallow end could be sufficient for the rest of their lives, and they might content themselves to simply hang out there for the rest of their lives. Some of the pools in Chicago seem to be indicating that that's the right way to go. If you're familiar at all with Pulaski Park and Pulaski Pool, they actually filled in the deep end a couple of years ago. I went to dive there one day and realized this is not safe any longer because what was 8 feet is now 4 feet. They made the calculation that deep ends are unnecessary. Why risk it? Why not just make the whole pool into a shallow end? And that way, there's no risk, no one could ever drown, and who really needs the deep end anyway? Shallow ends are sufficient. I think this is probably exactly what many of us do with our wellness, with our wholeness, with our health, with our self-care. We use self-care to master the shallow end of the pool, and then we mistake that for the whole pool. We think, okay, I'm here. I'm arrived now. I can live here in this comfortable place with safe ground underfoot. I won't drown. I have no need to push into that risky business of the deeps. I'll just live here. And living in the shallow end of the pool, when it comes to your personhood, when it comes to your wholeness, that can be very deceptive because it's not as though that's the end of the road necessarily. You can get better and better at shallow end living, right? You can challenge yourself in the shallow end even. You can challenge yourself, see how long you can hold your breath underwater, right? Maybe take on learning how to do a handstand, maybe run a Chicago marathon, right? Work very hard to lose weight and get down to a proper weight. Figure out exactly what it is to put in your body so that your gut chemistry is always at peak levels, right? Maybe even do some financial planning, get your whole house in order. There's lots to challenge yourself in the shallow end of health and wellness. You can believe that you're moving more and more deeply into wholeness as a person, into fullness of life and personhood, and never be leaving the confines of the safe, shallow place of life. Who needs the deep end? Who needs something risky? You can get all your life cleaned up, and why would you need any more than that? In the 1970s, the American sage, John Lennon, wrote a song called Crippled Inside. I don't think it ever got super popular, but it's a catchy little tune that goes something like this. You can shine your shoes and wear a suit. You can comb your hair and look quite cute. You can hide your face behind a smile. One thing you can't hide is when you're crippled inside. One thing you can't hide is when you're crippled inside. And this great American sage, of course, was pointing to a reality that he'd uncovered in his own soul, which is that the waters of the human heart run deep. The waters of your heart, the waters of my heart, run deep. And there is a way to manicure the externals. There's a way to clean up your life. There's a way to comb your hair and put on the right shoes, even do some therapy such that you think more positively and can wear a smile more regularly, a way to manage your stress, a way to get your whole life in order, to essentially clean your house, clean your room, and never really have to address the crippled bits within. There's a kind of health that actually can steer you away from the deep end. There's a kind of self-care that can actually convince you that you don't need the deep end, that you're just fine here in the shallow end. You can actually get to a place where your marriage kind of works and your kids sort of respect you and you are progressing in your career and everything's just kind of fine. And you don't have to press into the hardest and deepest places of your own soul. An ancient sage, a sage much more ancient than John Lennon, perhaps the original John Lennon, might have been King Solomon. We don't really know. He wrote this in Ecclesiastes chapter 7. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of birth. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of birth. This is a Hebrew parallelism. It's one of the most standard forms of Hebrew poetry. It's to have two repeating lines that are meant to parallel one another, such that the meaning of the first line is drawn out by the meaning of the second line. And so when you read this kind of poetry, you have to ask, what do these two lines have in common? How are they connected? Well, it might be easy to see how good ointment and the day of birth are connected. Because good ointment and newborns actually have a lot in common. They both smell wonderful. True enough. We see it, Bobby sitting right here with his wonderful bride and newborn. They smell wonderful, full of serenity, tranquility, beauty. This is the beginning of a story. It's an unstained story. It's something that has not been marred by any impurities. There's much to be desired, much that's lovely in newborns and precious ointment. But the sage says that a good name and the day of death are better. A good name and the day of death are better than precious ointment and the day of birth. Well, what do a good name and the day of death have in common? They both come at the end of the story. You can't have a good name if you're a no-name. There has never been a baby that has a good name. A good name is story-formed. A good name is the crown of a life lived. The sage is pointing us to the reality that the end is better than the beginning. Listen to what he says next in verse 2 through 4. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. For this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. You see the idea here? This is a weighty idea. This is a heavy thing. This is not something easily seen. But the sage is indicating that we are all on a trajectory. We're all going somewhere. And where we're going is the house of mourning. We're all on a trajectory toward sorrow. Our stories invariably are taking us there by a thousand different routes. Everyone's heading into that house of mourning in a different way, but we're all moving toward sorrow. We're all moving toward death. That's the end of our story here and now. And the sage says that to truly live is to face that reality. To truly live is to live in light of that reality, to not pretend as though that is not the case, but to instead to actually dive into the deepest kind of water and to ask the question, what is dead in you? Why are we on this trajectory toward sorrow, toward the house of mourning? Why are we moving toward the grave? He says, sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of face,
the heart is made glad.
This is a haunting truth that self-care, for all of its benefits, can and often does steer us away from. Self-care, for all its benefits, carries with it the danger of preventing us from going into the house of mourning, preventing us from going into the deeps, preventing us from asking, what is dead in me? What is broken in me? What is the sorrow that's in the deep waters of my heart? I mentioned that last year my back went out twice. But 2017, for me, some of you know, was a brutal year in far more ways than just that. It wasn't just my back that failed over the course of the year, but also dear, longtime friendships failed for me in 2017. And there is brokenness in me that contributed to that. I was a participant in those failures. So what am I to do now? In the wake of what were many sleepless nights and many tears shed, stress that was through the roof, what am I to do now in this year as all of that seems to have passed? What would caring for myself rightly recommend to me? Well, how about I run a marathon, right? How about I get more fit, more strong? How about I buy a new mattress and get some really good night's sleep? I've done all that. And it's been lovely. My mattress is wonderful. It had been 15 years. But what does that do about the broken things in me? What does any of that have to do with the death in me that manifested in these failed relationships of last year? One thing you can't hide is when you're crippled inside. If you've been here this summer, you know that we've been spending our time talking about dividing walls. That is, talking about the issues of our time that drive people apart. Self-care may not seem like such an issue more broadly, socially speaking, but self-care has tremendous potential to drive us apart from one another. Because self-care convinces us to stay in the shallow end rather than deal with the brokenness, the crippled bits within us that actually destroy our relationships, that actually cripple our relationships, that harm our friendships and our marriages, our relationships with our parents and our children. Self-care can actually talk us out of dealing with any of those things. Talk us out of even looking at them or acknowledging them. Now, maybe self-care could develop into something that is more about wholeness than that. Maybe it could develop into something that would push us deeper, push us into the depths of our own brokenness, something that would bring us together rather than divide us. But that would mean that self-care would have to adopt this idea of mourning. Included in the definition of self-care would have to be the idea of going to the house of sorrow, asking the hardest questions about ourselves, being willing to uncover the crippled things that are within us. There's some people that love me very dearly that have actually pushed me to care for this self in that way this year. To ask those questions. What is broken in me? What is it in me that contributes to the sorrow and mourning and ruin of this world? What is it in me that is pushing this world toward death? And I'm very grateful for that, though that has been a hard process of self-exposure and having those things brought to the fore and having to look at them and face them and not blame shift. I've started to see, actually, this year, even as I get more fit and am able to run more distances, I'm able to see just how broken and twisted I am internally. One of the things that's come to the fore for me is that I am someone who is deathly afraid of appearing foolish. Perhaps some of you can relate. And so I am someone who always wants to have an answer. Someone who always wants to have right thoughts, right words. And when I don't have those words, when I get in over my head relationally, I run. I run and I hide. I run to books and to podcasts and to lectures and to ideas, to all the things that make me feel safe and secure, because the hard truth for me is I care more about not looking foolish than I do about people. And I would rather not look foolish than stay present in a relationship where I feel like I have nothing to offer, where I get exposed as having very little to offer. That brokenness has hurt me and people around me. It's cost me and people who are very dear to me, and it's cost us dearly in recent years. Probably many of you can relate to that. That you care more about your own protection in some way than you do about other people. When you are those people's pastor or friend or husband or father, that hurts. And so I've heard a lot of people in the name of protecting myself, and sometimes I think that I've even used the idea of self-care as justification for that. I can't put myself in this situation right now. I just need to care for myself. I need to get myself out of this toxic place. I need to be well. And so I check out of relational hardship and run to hide in learning new ideas. Right, learning new ideas, that's good. That's a good way to develop as a person, to care for yourself. There's nothing wrong or evil with it, but what about when it's a shield against entering the hardest places of relationship? What about when it's just a way to avoid the deep end? Just stay in the shallow places. The ancient sage writes, "Better is the end of a thing than its beginning. And the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for angry lodges in the bosom of fools. Say not, why were the former days better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask this." He says the end is better than the beginning. The deep is better than the shallow. Where you're being taken, where you're being pushed, that's better than where you began. So don't resist it. When the deep presents itself, when the house of mourning comes for you, enter in. The sage here points out two ways that we resist entering into that house of mourning, resist entering into that hard thing, that deep place, that place that's going to make us see what's broken within us. He says anger. It becomes so easy to get angry when the house of mourning comes, when the deeps come calling, when you're being drawn out of the shallow end into the deep end. Anger is a way to keep the deep waters at bay, to hold them back. We would all rather feel angry than feel sad. Anger gives you marching orders. Anger gives you a war to wage. It gives you a villain to overcome. It gives you something to do. Sadness, sorrow, there's a resignation in that. There's a surrender in that. There's a giving up in that. And none of us want that. And so we turn quickly to anger, to self-righteousness, to blaming, to harsh words for others, rather than see and recognize the brokenness within us, rather than face the sorrow of our own contributions to hard and crippling places. We would do almost anything to not have to face our own brokenness. So the sage points out, when our anger fails, then some of us, we actually turn to nostalgia. That's maybe the second place that we turn. We remember a time before all these problems. I didn't used to hurt like this. All this pain is new. Therefore, the pain can't be anything to do with me. It can't be about what's in me. I've only had seemingly healthy and whole relationships in the past. This new pain, these new problems, this must be the result of these new people in my life or these new circumstances in my life. We pine for a time when life made more sense. I remember when life was easier, when things were simpler. And we confuse ourselves. I remember a time when I was whole. No, you remember a time when you lived in the shallow end. And now you're being called to the depths. It is so easy to mistake shallow living for whole living. And it is not. God invariably calls us all into the depths. And better is the end of a thing than its beginning. Every one of us, as we live over the course of our life, this is going to happen. God is going to begin to draw us into deeper water, draw us into asking those harder questions. What is happening within me? What is broken within me? Why am I a contributor to the sorrow and brokenness of this world? This is his plan for completing every human person. It was even his plan for completing the humanity of his own son. God called Jesus out of the shallow and into the depths. Jesus lived most of his life in the shallow. He was a carpenter. He worked a trade. He had loving parents, seemingly, for all we know. Lived in a hometown where people knew his name. And then God began to call him into deeper water, began to call him to see the sin and sorrow and brokenness of the world, to reckon with the mourning here, the sorrow here, the grief here. How instructive is it for us that even Jesus resisted that? Even Jesus wanted to stay in the shallow end. He didn't want to go into the depths, so much so that he scolded his own mother when she challenged him to make wine from water. "Woman, it's not my time," he said. "I want to stay here in the shallow end. I don't want to go into the depths." And then later, of course, famously praying to his father, "If it be possible, if there's any other way, let this cup pass from me," Jesus prayed, as he faced betrayal and arrest and crucifixion. I don't think anyone willingly goes into the house of mourning. I think we have to be sort of backed into it. God has to faithfully back us into it. We really, really want to stay in the shallow end. We all want to believe that health and wellness is about green tea and yoga mats. Wouldn't that be lovely?
maybe a marathon or two. Now, to be clear, to reiterate, those shallow expressions of self-care, those are gifts from God too. And even people who swim in the deeps, they need pause buttons. They need to go back to the shallow end. They need to take a break. No one can live in glory perpetually. We're too frail. We're too human. There's nothing wrong with the shallow end. Only don't mistake it for the whole pool. There's more. And the end of a thing is better. I've been reading novels lately. Part of my attempt maybe to warm my heart up from cold ideas. And a novel I read last month, it was a good one. It was about a werewolf that brought about the end of Western civilization as we know it. In the story, all of Europe is burning at the hands of this werewolf's sneaky devices, and he has now turned his Satan-like designs on North America. And there's a German woman in the novel who spent her life fighting this werewolf in Europe, and she is warning those in North America who would now stand up to this Satan-like figure, how it was that he achieved his success in Europe, how it was that he brought Europe to her knees. And she says this, "Where there is only flesh and no spirit, there's either pleasure or pain, and who would ever choose pain?" She's explaining how the devil brought Europe to its knees, and she says, "Where there is only flesh and no spirit, there's either pleasure or pain, and who would ever choose pain?" In other words, it's God who leads us into our pain. Without him leading us there, we wouldn't go there. Without him leading us there, we would content ourselves to live in the shallow end. We would never face the evil within us or the evil that faces us. We would never push back against anything that brings mourning or ruin or sorrow. We would content ourselves to the place of self-care. If we don't know that God is at work when the deeps come calling, we will be sure that the pain that we're looking at is pointless. We'll be sure that it's something to just be avoided, something to fix as soon as possible, something to escape by any means necessary. But the ancient sage closes this passage in Ecclesiastes by calling us to look beyond flesh, to look into the spirit. He writes this, "Consider the work of God, who can make straight what he has made crooked." I'm a broken man. There are broken things in me. And those broken things, they've cost me dearly. They've cost others dearly in recent years. It'd be very easy for me to not look very hard at that. But running a marathon is not going to do a lick of good to change any of it. God alone, who is Lord of the deeps, has hidden treasures for us there. I'm hoping and praying, maybe even he's hidden lost friends there to find again. Let's pray. Father, thank you for not leaving us to our shallow designs. Thank you for calling us into the deep end and for exposing and uncovering what is broken in us. I pray for the courage of your spirit for the people here, that we would not resist that, that we would not turn to anger or nostalgia or anything else that would steer us away from the deep liberation that you have for us. Father, show us what is crippled within us and meet us there with new life. Teach us to receive that new life. Make our hearts glad even as we face that sorrow. We ask it in Christ's name. Amen.